Welcome to The Pie. I'm your host, Tess Vigeland. Economists are always talking about the pie, how it grows and shrinks, how it's sliced, who gets the biggest share. In this show, we're talking about the most pressing matters of the day, seen through the lens of economics. The Pie is a production of the University of Chicago's Becker Friedman Institute. And in this episode, we're bringing you a panel discussion titled, Knowing When to Stop, the Unintended Consequences of Monetary Policy. The panel engaged in a discussion following a talk from Raghu Rajan, Catherine Dusak Miller Distinguished Service Professor of Finance at the Booth School of Business, about his book, Monetary Policy and Its Unintended Consequences. The panel featured Charles Evans, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, and was moderated by Randall Krosner, Norman R. Robbins Professor of Economics at Chicago Booth.
So thanks, Raghu, for a great presentation. And so why don't we turn to Charlie for a few minutes of reactions, because I know that Charlie has, I think, some slightly different views on some of these issues. And so that'll then provide a good basis for discussion. We'll go back and forth. But in good Booth tradition, don't wait until the end to ask a question. We can take questions along the way. Charlie?
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's a great pleasure to hear Raghu's views on this and see them enshrined in book. I've read a few speeches before, and we participated on a panel at the Brookings Institute, in the past. And I think you sort of identified me in your presentation. Not all central bankers will agree with this, so I just thought I'd highlight different perspectives. The thesis at the end is less is more for the central bank, and at some level maybe that's true, but I don't really agree with that as stated here. So I think you have to take into account what the responsibilities are for various institutions in the United States. It would be sort of an act of hubris for me to take on somebody else's responsibility or to ignore my own responsibility. So the Federal Reserve Act instructs the Federal Reserve to promote monetary and financial conditions to support maximum employment and price stability. Maximum employment is a little bit of a nebulous term to economists. The public would tend to kind of go, more is better, right? More people being employed is good. Price stability is something that the Fed has worked on to sort of try to define. And I think it would be irresponsible to ignore that. So the Fed has, after long deliberations, and Ben Bernanke got this started, decided that 2% is the objective for monetary policy as measured by the Personal Consumption Expenditure Index. The Consumer Price Index is a little better known. It tends to be about 35 basis points higher probably on average, but 2% on the PCE. Now, and that's symmetric, and so the idea that we shouldn't worry when it's low, I'm not quite sure, might depend on how much. We're not going to be able to fine-tune inflation, and if it were half a point too high, we probably shouldn't get our nose out of joint, just like if it was, 1.5. This is something that could be redefined judiciously, and the Fed has undertaken a framework in the past, and there have been, discussions about maybe the inflation objective should be different. Most people have asked for a higher one, not a lower one, but it could be lower. The key is really that inflation expectations are anchored, that markets understand what the Fed is going to do. And I think during the current environment where relative prices skyrocketed, not because of, monetary policy was extraordinarily accommodative, but used car prices went up 10% in 1 month. That's monthly rate, not annualized rate. 7% the next month, 10%, because semiconductor chips were in short supply. Lots of labor force issues and things like that. So inflation got very high. Anchored inflation expectations have been very important. All right, so the other thing is, and for all the young people in the room, you should be very concerned about this. Trend growth in the U.S. is low. It's 1.75% by most measures, people who are forecasting this. In the 80s, when I was younger, baby boomers coming into the labor market, we could enjoy about 3.25% growth when the economy was expanding. Everything else equal, growth solves an awful lot of problems. 1.75 is kind of low, and it's not surprising that, a number of theories will point you to the idea that real interest rates are going to be lower when growth is lower. So as we move down our star, a neutral measure of real interest rates for monetary policy, is lower. And by some measures, 0.5 percentage point. Maybe it's going up. Maybe it's going up for reasons having to do with public debt and not growth. But, it's been low. That means the federal funds rate, a neutral level, is going to be the real rate that's neutral plus the inflation objective. That's 2.5%. Now, when the economy tends to get into a recession, the Fed usually cuts interest rates by 500 basis points. And if you start at 250 basis points, you don't have 500. And so somehow getting accommodation in there is important. If you were to accept a lower inflation realization over time, and if that was embedded in market expectations, then that neutral rate is going to be lower, and you're going to have less capacity, you know, to address that. And so even before I talk about, which I will now, asset purchases, when you're at the effective lower bound, if you don't do something else, then you're going to have inflation less than 2%. You're going to underrun. And so asset purchases are used to do that. If you decide that you're uncomfortable going to the effective lower bound, as many people have said at various times, then inflation is going to be even worse. So quantitative easing, Raghu, in his book and other places, does what other people, you know, do as well, which is to describe this as unconventional monetary policy. But I think its real problem is it's become conventional monetary policy. And, you know, that is part of the toolkit. That's kind of difficult to leave behind, or you're going to always have low inflation. I could wish that growth were higher, but that's not going to work. Forward guidance has entered into the picture. We could talk about that. Quantitative easing, at various points in the book and the presentation, you could get the idea that at a point in time, what the Fed is doing is problematic, tightening, getting rid of reserves, causing problems for banks. I think one thing to keep in mind is, especially once we got going, quantitative easing is a plan over a period of time. Chair Powell has been extremely clear about the fact that he wants to round-trip asset purchase and bring the balance sheet back down to where it should be relative to the size of the economy, which 6, 7, 8 years later is going to be higher, but it's going to be as efficient as it could. And in 2019, the Fed was actually looking for a very efficient level of reserves and found out that they undershot, and that caused problems. And so I just don't understand why financial markets can't kind of understand the broad scope of what the plan is and do their risk management, you know, because of that. After all, people in financial markets are well compensated for taking risks.
And many of them have Booth degrees.
Well, that's a good mitigant. Thank you. Yes, that's. Now, if you don't like asset purchases, QE, one way to reduce that is if you increase the inflation objective from 2 to 4%, because then you'd have more of a cushion when you wanted to cut the funds rate to mitigate a recession, then you wouldn't have to go as much. And so you wouldn't have to embark upon quantitative easing as much. I think that's a pretty unpalatable solution for most people. So
why is that? Why don't you flesh that out?
Why is it unpalatable?
Yeah, because many people have proposed that, but obviously there are many people, especially sitting central bankers, who don't support that.
Well, I'm probably more comfortable with it than most people. I think so. My dissertation chair was Ben McCallum. Ben was a very good monetary economist, and I always remember he said economics was about two things. One, people do pretty well for themselves, which I think is rationality, and that's true. Second one is there's no such thing as money illusion. That last one, I think, is the problem. If you selected a higher inflation objective, now there's a bunch of ifs here, and if you delivered on that sequentially in the same sense that you did at 2%. That is, if the variability around your objective was no higher, we don't have a good theory that says that variability is related to the level, not a good theory. And in that case, plans would be for 4%, wages would be for 4%, mortgages would be for that. And actually the cost of that higher inflation would be shoe leather kind of costs, which everybody thinks are kind of small. So, I mean, in some sense, you could get comfortable with it, but I think the public would hate it. I think Ben Bernanke said at a recent Brookings conference, they said, why don't you go up to Congress? And he goes, well, if you go up to Congress and tell them that you want a higher inflation objective, you might come back down the hill with a lower inflation objective because they don't, you know, they suffer from money illusion and all of those things. Last thing I'll say on this without prompting is remittances on QE. We've definitely gotten to the point where the balance sheet's very large, duration on the balance sheet is high. interest rates have gone up. So if you marked all those assets to market, then you know you don't. Then you're underwater, or you've got losses there. At the same time, we're paying interest to banks on reserves, which we didn't before 2007 or 8. So that's a cost. And so when you put all this together, you can get to the point, as we are currently, where, yeah, the Fed's not able to send remittances to the Treasury. Now, again, what I would point out is over the sweep of the program, it is a program over time. In the early part of this, in the great financial crisis, Fed made a huge amount of money on the asset purchases because the balance sheet was so big. And we sent that to the Treasury. I think the proper way to evaluate this would be over the life, some reasonable expected life of the plan, and make allowances for where we are now. But again, the political concerns there is always on the short term, so that's a problem.
I wasn't even worried about whether the Fed was making money over the long term or not. It's more that has Congress and the Treasury planned for this by extending maturities? And I don't think they have. And so when you put the balance sheets together, actually the maturities have fallen. The Treasury maturities have been about 65 months on average. They haven't adjusted for Fed maturities. And that's the problem. The average maturity has actually shrunk. And more recently, they've been issuing short term. But I thought those were great comments. And look, I think there is an issue about the target, whether it should be symmetric or asymmetric, right? And what I've been saying is maybe an asymmetric target, which is what the ECB had under Trichet, is probably okay also, because you fight inflation when it goes above your target, but when it goes below, you're a little more relaxed. Now, I think Charlie points out a good point, which is, could that eventually create problems in terms of expectations and so on? Perhaps. But that is something to be seen. And maybe you want to do something when inflation sort of goes into galloping deflation. But we sort of seem to be like Chicken Little, afraid of the sky falling down. We haven't seen galloping deflation since the Great Depression. Now, it may be that's because we've got all these tools in place. But in some sense, even Japan didn't see galloping deflation. And the Japanese keep saying a little deflation wasn't so bad. That was an attempt to get rid of it. They've built up enormous amounts of public debt. And I think public debt is going to be their bigger problem in the years to come. On the issue of low growth, I mean, there's so many reasons for low growth other than monetary policy. And my sense is we need to tackle those. I mean, part of it is the labor force is growing older, is not growing at the same pace it was growing. But there are so many other reasons, including the education of the labor force, which we need to work on.
I might need a bit clearer on that. I meant to say that trend growth is 1.75%, and you put that, it's like about 1.5% is productivity growth, that's structural. Can you do something about that? Education, things like that. 0.3% is maybe labor input not growing, aging of the population. Are you going to be more relaxed about immigration? You can't birth 25-year-olds, but you can let people into the country.
Absolutely.
You're right, absolutely. Structural factors are there.
Right.
And those are way beyond. That's not what the Fed is just responding to the environment.
Exactly. So I think where we differ is I say the Fed should say, okay, that's not our problem. You guys handle that. And put it back to Congress to say, look, we can't help in this case. We've done what we.
Well, no, that's right.
That's right. Yeah. And the last point is, I think we're surprised again and again by how short-sighted financial markets are, especially with all the brilliant people we train from here. And
not enough of them.
And I think that's part of the problem. We think financial markets should understand these problems. But maybe they understand them too well. They know that when they take advantage of this, and they take these really illiquid positions, and the stuff hits the roof, the Fed will come back in and bail them out. In other words, are they naive? And that's quite possible, they are. Or are they extremely clever, knowing that they're betting on the Fed being at hand? And I know that there are some hedge funds which take enormous positions, levered 100 times, knowing that they're picking up pennies in front of the road roller. But they know that when they get crushed, a lot of other people are going to get crushed, and then they can rely on significant support. Have we got to that phase, and is that what the problem really is? Anyway, let's continue.
Great. And so, Charlie, on that, because in some sense, Raghu was just talking about the classic moral hazard problem, that people take on more risk when they get all the upside and somebody else kind of helps them on the downside. How much of a concern did you have in some of these interventions that you were creating this sort of moral hazard that Raghu was just talking about, that the bond market's become anesthetized, people don't react as they should, and too much risk is being taken?
Well, I think you know, listening to that, I think for banks that's a, you know, serious concern, or at least, I mean, too big to fail, you know, is an issue. And certainly when Silicon Valley and, you know, Signature Bank and others went down, the depositors who became nervous about, you know, uninsured deposits, or they just weren't getting as much interest as, you know, money markets, they sort of switched over, you know, and that type of thing. So, I mean, you know, that's part of the too big to fail issue. You know, in terms of hedge funds, everything you described in terms of the risks that they're taking ring true to me. Hedge funds do go under, though. They close those down. If you're really in a bad situation, you're going to, you know, you're going to suffer there. So I don't think they get the same benefit that perhaps the banking system, where you kind of go, this is large. They're going to spend some period of time rebuilding their capital after the great financial crisis, and everything that I do is still not going to change the fact that they want to build more capital and lending is going to be lower, you know, for some period of time. I guess if you listed a couple of the implications that really worry you about financial stability, I wasn't quite sure I saw things on the slide that hit the red zone in my mind there. I mean, the dash for cash, you know, 2020, you just had a huge number of positions that were being unwound at one time, and you needed that liquidity in order to settle all of those trades. And, you know, that's something that was going to happen. I don't know how that made somebody feel better about taking, because people were taking losses, right? I mean, they needed the cash just to settle and take the losses.
So do you have the same view on that? Because, you know, this I'm very sympathetic when there's a major market disruption, like when the Treasury market really stopped functioning in late February, early March of 2020, when COVID hit. People were just dumping Treasury securities, including central banks, and so the risk spreads really, or the bid-ask spreads really grew out. Treasury market's deepest, most liquid market in the world, kind of the benchmark market. So once people felt uncomfortable about being able to trade Treasuries, said, boy, if I can't get rid of Treasuries, I'm not going to be able to get rid of anything else. And so they, you know, we saw this pounding down of asset prices, and so the Fed intervened and other central banks intervened, I think reasonably, but was there sort of a moral hazard problem associated with that? Would you have been more wary of doing that? Because obviously you're a little bit more concerned about QE.
You can't avoid intervening in those environments, and the markets know it. They absolutely know it. And so those are environments in which they know that they will be bailed out. So take spreads, which, you know, normal times you make those pennies. And then if they widen too much and you're a well-diversified fund going under happens when everything else blows out. That's when the Fed comes in. So you're much better protected. Small guys, yes, I can see them going belly up. Think about the big hedge funds. We know their names. Those guys take enormous positions, and they know that the only chance they have of going bust is when everything else is going belly up, all correlations sort of in the tails. And that, they know, the Fed will come in. Now, I mean, another way of seeing this is, how much liquidity does the Fed have to provide, right? Used to be $50 billion in reserves before the global financial crisis. The market couldn't handle anything near that before the pandemic, right? September 2019, I don't know what the number was, but it was excess of $1 trillion in reserves, and the market went belly up then. The market went belly up, And therefore, as the this was September 2019, March 2020, the dash for cash, everything went well, and the Fed came in with a huge expansion of its balance sheet. Of course, now as it's tightening its balance sheet, we've already seen one episode, Silicon Valley Bank. Now that's not just its tightening; it's also what they did with the money, which is investing in long-term treasuries, assuming that long-term interest rates would, as their CEO says, long-term interest rates will never go up because Chairman Powell told us that. But
he wasn't listening.
Yeah. But you know, this I just think that the Fed is getting drawn in more and more, and I understand Chairman Powell wants to pull it out over time. Let's see how successful that phase is. In all this, it is much easier going in than coming out. I mean, recall one of the big issues when Chairman Powell took over was the Fed put, right? There was a sense the Fed put was alive and well. It was the Greenspan put, which became the Bernanke put, which became the Yellen put. So he didn't want it to be the Powell put. And therefore, the Fed moved quite strongly on raising interest rates right till December 2018. And in December 2018, it turned on a dime in 2 weeks, right? Saying, yes, nothing wrong with the economy. We're going to raise interest rates. And I don't want to comment on internal discussions then. But in 2 weeks, there was President Trump sort of shouting from the sidelines saying, this is terrible. The Fed is tanking the economy. But there was no real data which came between when the Fed said, we're going to continue, this is fine, we don't care about market volatility, to turning on a dime and saying, we're going to cut interest rates. That, I think, to many observers, verified the fact that the Powell put was alive and well. And I think the more the markets depend on the central bank to bail them out, the more they take positions in that regard, the more you know, problematic it becomes, even politically. You know, it if you're bailing out the fat cats, which you have to. I'm not in any way saying you shouldn't come in at that time because the alternative would be much worse. I'm not saying liquidate the economy, but you have to worry about what led to that and try and back off from that. And it becomes more and more difficult over time.
So the Evans put.
So I would describe the 2018-2019 period somewhat differently. So Jay Powell comes in as chair, and you know Janet Yellen has started the increase in the funds rate after being at zero until December of 2015, and then getting a weak 25 basis point increase in, and then not being able to do it until December of 2016. Then off we go, 25 basis points a meeting, except for one meeting. All right. So then Jay comes in, and you're going up, and you're only at 2.5 or something, right? So you don't think that this is extremely restrictive, and you know that you just got a tax cut from the Trump administration, plus additional government spending that was slated to add $2 trillion to the debt over 10 years. And so you kind of go at the top of the cycle, unemployment's low, that you know, you're adding, you know, fiscal stimulus. And so, you know, you continue to do this. Now you get to December 2018, and the markets had become nervous. They probably were nervous because they were overextended on some of these financial bets, like, you know, what you've been talking about in that context. And so they were wanting to hear from Chair Powell at the press conference, well, we're still reducing the balance sheet, but we are paying attention, and maybe we will slow it down or stop. And among all of the questions that the chair answered, which were a little difficult and rocky, the most confident answer that he delivered, if you go back and look at it, was, what are you going to do about QT? And he goes, we're going to keep doing this as if it's on, you know, autopilot or something. He was very confident about it. Markets vomited at that point. And the Fed, yeah, within 2 weeks, they had that three-chair discussion at the American Economic Association meetings,
yes.
Right? You know, there's a lot of drama, you know. Anyway, PR. But what the Fed did was they sort of stopped and looked at how things are going, because the data were beginning to get a little weaker. The economy is getting weaker. Why? Well, the Trump administration started a trade war in the middle of 2018, and all of a sudden, manufacturing went into a mini recession. And by the time of monitoring the data in the spring and the summer, it wasn't until maybe July or September that the Fed actually started, and they cut by three times. And so they proceeded cautiously. It wasn't in 2 weeks. And I thought it was thoughtful, given the circumstances. It was complicated. But the markets definitely felt that they were extended and they wanted something from the Fed, which they did not get from Jay.
Well, the language changed, right? That was the, and you're all about signaling the language.
We always said that we were monitoring and we could change. It always says that. Yeah, There's always a sense.
You're Charlie, that's true. But I think what the market took away was the Fed blinked. I think if you ask any market participant, that is the message they took away. The Fed blinked.
I will not argue with that.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges is, I think central banks in general have not been as clear in distinguishing actions for financial stability reasons versus monetary policy reasons. And so, you know, for example, the intervention in late February, early March of 2020, when COVID hit, the economy was being explicitly closed down by policy. Sometimes policy ends up causing the economy to turn down. That's usually an unintended consequence. Obviously, in COVID, it was an intended consequence to shut things down. And so you're having this incredible disruption in the financial markets, and so the Fed intervenes, I think quite reasonably. And I think we all kind of agree that at least narrowly in that time, the alternative would have been a lot worse if the Treasury market had become completely dysfunctional and every other asset price had collapsed. I think the challenge is that then the Fed, as well as many other central banks, didn't make a really clear distinction between the intervention for financial stability reasons versus for monetary policy reasons. And you know, you saw in Raghu's charts how just the amount of reserves in the system, the Fed's balance sheet just exploded and continued to explode after that initial period. Now, certainly there was a lot of uncertainty, but the unemployment rate started coming down very, very rapidly. The amount of fiscal stimulus was enormous compared with the global financial crisis. Basically, everything was sort of six times what it was in the global financial crisis. And I think one of the challenges that the Fed had and continues to have is not clearly articulating when they're doing something for one reason versus another. And as Eric had mentioned, I recently joined the Financial Policy Committee at the Bank of England. And the Bank of England has a structure where they explicitly separate monetary policy decision-making from financial stability decision-making. But it's not just that it's separated, it's elevated to the same level. There are two committees, both of which are chaired by the governor of the Bank of England, each of which have some outsiders on them. I'm on the Financial Policy Committee, not on the Monetary Policy Committee. But it raises the level of concern about financial stability to that height. And so when there was a disruption in the UK Treasury markets, the UK gilt markets, the so-called liquidity-driven investments, LDI, about a little bit more than a year ago, interest rates were skyrocketing, market was dysfunctioning. The Bank of England intervened. But there, and this is, and I want to get your guys' responses on this. What Andrew Bailey did said, okay, we're doing quantitative tightening, but we're going to be buying these assets. So the market said, yeah, one's negative and one's positive. How do you square those two? And he said, this is temporary and targeted. I'm doing this because there's a particular thing that's happening in these markets, and on Friday I'm going to stop. Now talk about markets vomiting. I was in Washington when Andrew articulated. This is before I was on the committee, so I get no credit or blame for this. So he said, and it's going to be Friday, and the markets were like, "You've got to be kidding me," because we know that, like the Fed, they started buying assets in March of 2020. The markets stabilized a month later, and you know, a few years later, they're still buying assets at just an enormous rate. But Andrew said, this is a separate thing. We're going to buy these assets. And if we take any losses on these, the Treasury is going to indemnify us. So getting back to that issue that you were talking about the losses, really separate these things out. The Financial Policy Committee, which I was not a part of, blessed that, said, yes, go ahead and do that. But that's temporary and targeted. And then I think they've been able to maintain their credibility in reducing the balance sheet and also making that clear distinction. So if something else goes wrong, they can draw that distinction out. I think the Fed has not done that, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Fed got into trouble. And so now, given that, so I'm kind of putting the blame a little bit on the Fed. So Charlie, maybe we start with you, and then Raghu, I'd love to get your view on whether that's one way to address some of the problems that you articulate in your book.
So, I mean, that was a very dramatic and exciting period. I was in London when that happened.
Oh, so it's your fault.
Well, usually it's my fault.
I just happened to be a bystander. I had some meetings at the Bank of England, and they were very generous and honored the schedule at a time when they were very busy. But anyway, so the Bank of England is an example where the financial stability requirement puts you in a different direction than the monetary policy. So that's exactly where the dilemma is. If you look at 2020, the Fed started off with asset purchases and described $120 billion a month. That was greater than the $85 billion per month that we did during the Great Financial Crisis. Economy's bigger, so it makes sense. But it started off as market functioning. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was financial stability.
Totally
and,
reasonable.
You know, the good news there, there is it was aligned with accommodation, which was necessary. You're right, unemployment was coming down, but it went up to 14, almost 15%. And it was still at 7% late into what we were doing. And so you had to have a lot of confidence that we were going to continue going down. But that was a case where they were aligned. Now, clearly there are improvement opportunities in the implementation details for how you do asset purchases, not only how long you do them or when you're doing them. Start off with market functioning. Did we really need to do it for the economy? And as long as that, there'll be a lot of soul searching over that for sure. And then tapering, which the other playbook said we had to taper, so I guess that sort of extended the delay into 22. So there's a lot to look at. But it's a big ask for financial stability, if unemployment's high, inflation's low, and markets are having such a party that you think you need to rein them in for financial stability so that you need to send unemployment higher and inflation lower. Talk about Main Street not understanding that. This is why you need a regulatory authority, somebody else separate from monetary policy, who hopefully would have mitigated this at the outset, but then been able to do some things.
Yeah, no, look, I think for all those reasons, actually Don Cohn has written, a former Fed vice chairman, has written pieces saying the U.S. has no financial stability authority of significance and that it really needs somebody separate. And I think the Bank of England has a very good model because the governor of the Bank of England sits on both committees and therefore internalizes what each committee is saying so that they don't need to work at cross purposes. That's one model. I don't think it's the only model. But I do think that paying more attention to financial stability while setting monetary policy is important. I don't advocate sort of raising interest rates just because the markets are high and when unemployment is sky high. But I do think when unemployment is low and the markets are taking off, perhaps at that point you might want to think about whether you want to keep pressing on the accelerator, whether it's through quantitative easing or through really, really low interest rates, negative interest rates in the case of the ECB. So,
but you should also admit, I mean, I agree with that. And so in that circumstance, you know, if it's kind of like, well, I'd kind of like to be more accommodative in order to help out on the dual mandate a little bit more, but, I'm willing to balance this thing out, and that makes sense.
And that gives that gives you the room to cut later on also.
Right, that's right. But you also ought to be able to admit, I have to do this because the other regulatory authorities aren't doing their jobs and they're letting people take, exuberant bets and things like that, and that never takes place.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And that's, and no surprise, Don Cohn is actually one of my predecessors on the Financial Policy Committee in the UK, that he's drunk from the same Kool-Aid that I have, that I think this is a very good approach.
He's always been our predecessor, and anything you've ever done, me too, 40-year career at the Fed.
That's certainly true. Great man. But I think it's a very interesting thing to think about it. Another thing, again, that this happened before I got onto the Financial Stability Committee, but one thing that they did is when they ran the stress tests on banks last year, they said, well, let's do a different stress. The stress that the Fed did and every other central bank that runs stress tests did is, well, let's do another scenario where we get even a greater recession than we had before. Because that's basically what the stress tests have been since the global financial crisis. What are the shocks that we're seeing? Can they stand just a bigger and bigger version of that? What they did last year in the UK is said, well, we've done that a lot. Why don't we do something a little different something crazy. What if interest rates get to 5 or 6% over the next year? That's crazy, but you know, we're not forecasting that. But what will be the consequences? And I think it's because they had this structure that they asked those questions, and other central banks didn't ask those questions. Now, did they avoid all the problems? No, there was the liquidity-driven investment challenge that the Bank of England had. So it's not like it's a cure-all for everything, but I think it's a way of trying to focus on these issues.
So I want to thank the panel for coming. Raghu with his book, Randy for moderating, Charlie for being here. Thank you so much.
The Pie is a production of the Becker Friedman Institute for Economics and part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network. If you'd like to keep in touch with the latest economic research from the University of Chicago, you can visit bfi.uchicago.edu/subscribe. Have you ever wondered who you are but didn't know who to ask? Well, then join Professor Eric Oliver as he poses the 9 most essential questions for knowing yourself to some of humanity's wisest and most interesting people. 9 questions with Eric Oliver, part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network. Our theme music was composed by Story Mechanics, production assistance from the BFI Communications team. I'm Tess Vigeland, your host and executive producer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.